Welcome to ACMN Conversations, a podcast about media, marketing and entertainment. I'm ACMN's Managing Director, Lyndall Pond. We are particularly excited about today's guest as we wanted to celebrate International Women's Day by interviewing one of Australia's most impressive ladies. With a career close to our hearts in media and marketing, as well as time on arts boards, including the Melbourne Theatre Company and Melbourne International Arts Festival. Welcome, Jeanette. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Lyndall. It's just such a pleasure to be here.
Now, we like to get context. So I'm actually just going to read your biog so that our listeners get a sense of the caliber of person we're interviewing today. Jeanette has held various senior management roles in her career, including Senior Vice President of Marketing at Galaxy Entertainment Group in Macau, China, Executive General Manager of Marketing at Crown Melbourne, General Manager at Pacific Brands, Managing Director of Emich Limited, and Managing Director of Clemenger Digital and Clemenger Proximity. Jeanette is currently a Director of Tab Courts Holdings and Non-Executive Director of Vicinity Centres, KM Property Funds, Costa and Visit Victoria. And she was previously a Director of Nine Entertainment and Welcome Group Limited. So that there is an impressive list of organisations to have had really significant roles in. So I wanted to start at the beginning when you were working in some very high profile media agencies in the senior roles we've talked about, including that one at Emich, a digital advertising agency, for those that don't know about it. That would have been one of the first digital agencies of its kind in Australia, if not the first, I imagine. So I wanted to ask you about some of the key challenges you faced when digital was just still so new at that time.
Yeah, thanks, Lyndall. Well, that is casting my mind back to actually 1999. I was the CEO of Emich. It was a publicly listed company. There were at the time lots of digital or web production companies really trying to find their way. Emich was actually an online media company, and it came out of Mitchell & Partners. But as I said, it was publicly listed. And if you think in 1999, pretty much no one was advertising online, which is really extraordinary in today's, if you fast forward to today's context, where I think something like 95+% of ad dollars goes to online. So look, the biggest challenge back in 1999 as the CEO of Emich was actually educating people on this thing called the internet. And just prior to joining Emich, I'd spent the last 5 years of my career at Clemenger, where we did a digital startup company called Clemenger Digital. And that business model was around advising clients how to take their brands online. So that was more like a strategy consulting business. This one was actually, you know, trying to sell advertising online. So as I said, the biggest challenge was really educating people about the internet, and also for those brave clients that were advertising online, it was actually developing the skills within our team to navigate our way around the web to actually find an audience and engage an audience. And we were learning about, you know, different forms, ad forms online, trying to understand how people were using the internet. I mean, I think from memory, Google didn't exist. I don't think Google existed then.
I don't think so.
So some of the search engines were starting up.
I think we had Ask Jeeves back in those.
Yeah, we had things like that. But the one little anecdote I will leave you with on the Emich conversation was one of my first meetings was with these two young guys, and they were brothers, and we were in a contract negotiation to represent their ad space on their website, and those brothers were the Bassett brothers, and the contract was between Emich and their new startup company called Seek. So I guess that sort of puts it in context what was happening at the time. It was incredibly enjoyable. It was new frontiers. It was a whole environment of a whole lot of believers. People who worked in the space at that stage were really believers against all the people who just wished that the whole internet thing would go away and that it was a folly. Because if you think 1999, I think was a year, I think it might have been just post the year that the dot-com bubble had burst as well. So everyone was licking their wounds, and but the people working in the digital space were great believers, and we could see a new future, and a future from a marketing perspective that allowed us into the holy grail of being able to interact directly with consumers. And then the other thing that really excited me was how in the digital space, startup space, we were changing organizational culture, because it was full of a whole lot of renegades.
Yeah, I was going to, one of my comments on all of this was going to be, I know when we first started using it, because accessing the internet was free, a lot of our clients really struggled that you had to pay to advertise on it. It was that the concept of paying for advertising on a platform that was free to use seemed to be a bit of a leap in our space, which I found really interesting. So commercializing what you were doing and selling and buying and selling ad space, I imagine, would have been a big part of what everyone was figuring out at the time.
Yeah, which in the context of free-to-air, you'd think, well, that's weird, because free-to-air is free. But it was, look, a lot of it was around not understanding the technology, not using it either. You know, we were still getting clients that we were having to sit down and you know, crank up the dial-up modem and get a web page up and show them what was online. There were no measurement tools.
No.
So there was no Google Analytics. So it was just a leap of faith and trust to say, well, you know, this is actually about, treat it as R&D. This is about learning and exploring. You know, let's.
What can we learn?
And what can we learn from it? So the organisations that did that, you know, it was interesting. The Defence Force were a big client of eMitch.
Oh, yeah.
And they were doing a lot of recruiting online. Nissan was also a client of ours. So they were, and they were both using it as R&D. But Nissan were just putting their toe in the water. They'd all been burnt, because if you think about that sort of era from 95 to 2000, people were just throwing a whole lot of money into building websites, and they were brochureware, and they didn't quite know, you know, they were like putting annual reports up online and expecting something to happen. Well, of course, nothing happened. So I think in that context, to then go from, well, we've just spent a whole lot of money building websites and we're not generating any revenue out of that, to now go, now you want us to advertise online. You can't give us any post-analysis reports. You can't give us any metrics. We don't even know who's online. So...
Yeah, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Although I still think in many ways, in a context today, a lot of digital innovation still requires, particularly in the boardroom, a mindset that a lot of it is about R&D.
I was going to say that. I couldn't agree more. You know, it's still a platform on which we can test concepts and trial things, and we can learn stuff, and that informs decisions that we make both in the online space and the offline space. So it actually, you've sort of just reminded me that it still is that kind of a tool, that R&D and test and learn. And look, the world has just moved on quickly, but I also wanted to ask you, how do you stay digitally informed these days? Because it's such a, you're not sort of on the tools, so to speak. You know, you're looking much bigger picture, but it's still an area of expertise for you. How do you keep yourself abreast of what's happening?
Yeah, look, that's such a great question. And look, I learn by doing. So, you know, any new thing that I hear about, you know, I'll be straight onto it. So, you know, I was an early adopter of social media, and much to the horror of my two children at that time, because I was in their space, you know, in the early days of Facebook. So I'm a great believer in using the digital space to just understand what's happening. So if I hear of a new platform, like when TikTok came along, you know, I'll jump on and try and you know, understand what's going on there.
Have you uploaded a TikTok?
My daughter has uploaded a TikTok, you know, in the classic lockdown activities.
Well done.
TikToks were being made, but yes, I have featured in one, but I haven't personally.
Good on you.
Yes, I do a lot of that. I'm also a big reader. So I will, you know, I've got some of my favorite places that I go to read things. I loved it when I discovered the Singularity University in the States, which I think is based in Silicon Valley or in and around there. You know, so I subscribe to a lot of interesting articles. I really like mixing with people in the startup space as well. So there's, you know, a great organization called Startup Victoria. So I guess, yeah, a lot of it's self-learning. But I think as marketers as well, you know, we've got to keep an ear to the ground and also keep our eyes open to what's going on and immerse ourselves in that world, whatever that world happens to be. Like at the moment, you know, I think that massive obsession with Wordle, for example, is, you know, I'm addicted already. So I'm just responsive to, you know, what's happening in the market. I never say that I'm an expert in it because I'm not, but I try to read a lot, do a lot, and spend as much time as I can in and around people who are actually operating fully in that space.
Yeah, they're great tips. Thank you. And I want to stay in that agency space, and I don't want to lead the witness reminding you we're here for International Women's Day, but I do, I think I've read somewhere that you've compared agencies when you worked in agencies land to scenes from Mad Men, which requires sort of no further explanation. But what do you think's changed since then? And I'm particularly interested in what you think we perhaps need to do more of.
Wow. I'm not sure that I can really give great insight into what's changed now because I don't really have much to do with agencies anymore. I can make some observations on what I think has happened. But yes, the Mad Men reference, it was a throwaway comment in an interview, I think, with The Australian or The Financial Review. So it has lived on. And in some ways it's with fond memories that it was like that. And then in a whole lot of other ways, there's not so fond memories because it was clearly, you know, in the time that I, you know, worked in advertising agencies and I worked in great agencies, they were very male dominated. The cultures were male. Despite that, you know, I've had a fantastic career in agencies and worked with extraordinary clients. I think potentially from an outside view now, not working directly with agencies, but I am encouraged to see greater diversity in the leadership of agencies. You know, when I worked at Clemenger, I think I was the first woman appointed to the board of Clemenger. And at the time, that actually made the front pages of the business section of The Age. Yeah, you know, that was big news. That a woman was being appointed, and I've still, my mother kept the article and I found it the other day and I was having a good old chuckle because it was nothing about my skills and experience. It was just this gender article. So I think that, you know, as we've seen, and we are talking about International Women's Day today, you know, we have seen some significant shifts in leadership. Now, we've made progress, but there's still a hell of a long way to go. But I think, yeah, there's been more embracing of that, or maybe there's just been a real, you know, recognition in an agency or enough sort of mass of senior women really just pushing through some of those barriers and changing the culture. I mean, the cultural expectations both within business and externally have also changed significantly from my reference to working in advertising in the 80s was like Mad Men. I mean, the behaviours and what was acceptable then, socially acceptable I'm talking about, is absolutely not socially acceptable now. You know, we've had major shifts in diversity in the workplace and what that means and organizations and individuals are now held accountable for creating a safe place for people to work or not. So I think that's really been the biggest change that's washed across the industry. But I think it's washed across society, and it's therefore washed across every business, you know, around the world, or certainly in the Western world.
Yeah, totally. And I think you hit the nail on the head regarding culture. The last podcast we did was around diversity, and my biggest takeouts from talking to Cecily was it goes beyond diversity. It's actually about inclusion and belonging, and that is a cultural shift, and that sense of inclusion and belonging is happening in all workplaces, in all schools. It's just, we're talking about it now, we never used to, and that is a huge leap and a relief because we're heading in the right direction.
I think you're right, Lyndall. You know, that the word belonging is incredibly powerful. I think when we talk about diversity, in a sense, it can be misconstrued. And it can be seen as, you know, a bias the other way.
Yep.
But I think when we talk about belonging, and I think Brené Brown is the person that we should
thank for
that. I'm certainly seeing it across the boards that I am involved with, that this word belonging is driving the cultural changes in organisations. And I think what I love too is diversity is being spoken about in the broadest context of the meaning of diversity.
Yeah.
But it all sits under the word of belonging.
Mm. Yeah, so, it was a really big takeout for me when we chatted a couple of weeks ago with Cecily. It was fascinating. And just staying in agency land just for a little bit longer, do you have an example of a time where you saw women supporting women that perhaps helped us take these steps towards a more diverse or a more inclusive future?
Yeah, gosh, it's a hot topic, isn't it? Because I really want to find the person who really started that view that women, an overall sweeping statement that women don't support women. I mean, I have had examples where I think women could have been more supportive of one another, and I'm not discounting that people have experienced that throughout their careers. I have not overtly felt women not supporting me, but you never know whether that's been happening directly or indirectly. I think on the positive side, you know, through my time at Clemenger, one of the most fabulous women that I worked with was actually an external consultant that we hired. Her name was Peggy, and Peggy was an external head of people and culture. So it was a bit of an oxymoron in the 1990s to have that function in an agency. And in fact, we clearly weren't brave enough to employ someone doing that full time. So it was, we had an external consultant, and I was on the board of Clemenger at that time, and we were given portfolio responsibilities on the board and was in an executive director role. So my two responsibilities were the people and culture piece, wasn't called that then, it's called HR, and the other responsibility was digital transformation. So they were the two pillars. So I worked very closely with Peggy, and you know, to cut a long story short, she was a huge supporter of me in the context of just private conversations, to be honest, because she gave me some great advice. And, you know, I, over my career, I actually worked at Clemenger for 15 years. And it's interesting now to look back at that and go, well, I mean, it was fantastic for most of the time. But I actually had all my eggs in that basket, and my career goals were very much set in the context of Clemenger. And Peggy sort of opened my eyes up a little bit. She wasn't encouraging me to leave, but she said, look, you're not going to find everything that you're looking for in one organisation. And she actually said to me, look, I know how much you love, you know, work sitting on boards, and you love, you know, your role on the board of Clemenger, that you're involved in the strategy of the business and you are enjoying the involvement in some of these new emerging areas like people and culture and digital. And she said, why don't you look outside for some more board roles. So Peggy really was a great supporter of mine in having that conversation and encouraging me to look outside the organisation for my own professional development and some of the things that I enjoyed doing. So she was a huge supporter.
Well, that's a very good segue, actually, because I think it was sort of, you know, mid-career or along the line there, you did have a fairly significant career change because you did have, you know, this bigger kind of goal in mind. So, yeah, tell us about what that was and where that led you.
Yeah, I think you're referring to me leaving the world of marketing. Is that
yep, right? And heading yeah. over to Pacific Brands, was it?
Yeah, I did. So actually that was after I left Clemenger after 15 years. I joined eMitch, which was, we were speaking about eMitch before, the digital, the internet company that it was called, internet media company it was called then. I don't think we're even using the word digital, but anyway. And I joined Pacific Brands. So actually, an external recruiter who is a very close personal friend of mine encouraged me to get operational experience. And she said, at some point in your career, I would really encourage you to do that. And an opportunity, I just started speaking to a few companies and I met the CEO of Pacific Brands, and it was pre-float and they were wanting to bring in people with different skills and experience into the organization. So it was perfect timing in a sense. It was serendipitous that they were looking for someone different. And I, you know, was introduced to them and I joined. So I completely left the world of marketing and advertising and went in as the head of the SOC division of Holeproof. You know, responsible for local manufacturing. We had a factory out in Nunawading and also a big component of our product development and sourcing was in China.
It's a big shift, isn't it? And I was interested in your move from marketing to operations around some of the skills and some of the things that, you know, you obviously took with you. It's a new role and they wanted something different, but you definitely would have had some really core skills or even traits that would have come in handy. Can you talk to that?
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because the business, the role that I was put in and the business that I was leading was in a world of pain. So it was significantly underperforming. And so it was a turnaround, which is pretty interesting that I was given a turnaround opportunity. Maybe they thought I couldn't make more of a mess of it because it was already in a mess.
It needed some brand and positioning. But
it did, actually. It did. It needed a lot of that. And, look, I think I actually did sit down, I think one night, I might have shared this story with you previously, but one night I was sitting in my office out in Nunawading and everything, it must have been about 5:30, 6 o'clock, and all of a sudden it was very quiet and I remember sticking my head out of the office and no one was there. And I wasn't used to that, you know, in my advertising roles we were always there late at night and all that stuff.
Midnight.
Yeah. And so I remember just sitting quietly because I did have a moment of going, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm sitting out in this operations role. There's a whole lot of stuff I don't know. What have I done? And this business is in a mess. And everyone's gone home.
It's just and, me.
Yeah. And anyway, but it gave me, you know, this time to pause and reflect and go, hang on a minute, stop focusing on all the things you don't know. And just for a moment, sit here and talk about the things you do know and why you were hired and what you've been brought in to do. And then with that list of stuff that you don't know, work out how you're going to fill the gaps. So I think I did bring a whole lot of skills in terms of leadership of people. I brought a whole lot of skills in terms of brand and strategy. And they had a massive portfolio of brands that were just an absolute scramble. And they'd stopped innovating in terms of product development. I actually also had a great deal of retail experience because I'd worked on both in FMCG clients, but also I spent something like 18 years working closely with Craig Kimberley, who was the founder of Just Jeans. So I actually really understood all of our customers who were, you know, everything from department stores to supermarkets, discount department stores and independents in between. So I actually understood the retail landscape. And of course, as a marketer, we naturally are inquisitive, and our inquisitiveness really starts and ends with consumers. So I sort of brought all of that in, and that had been lost in the business. What I didn't know was some of the more, all of a sudden I was operating in a far more complex financial environment. You know, there was a factory running 24/7 out the back as well. And we had 80% of our product up in China. So I just set about a program of learning. I became absolute best friends with the CFO. So I didn't pretend to know about product pricing and doing deals with retailers and all that stuff. I had to learn to do that. And also I had a great team of people who were absolutely across all of that. I had to get comfortable with the fact that I didn't know it. And I don't know that I ever did really get completely comfortable, because I think as a leader, you sort of, I know I thought at the time I needed to know everything. I think I'd be better in that role now, actually.
and a bit of trust in your team.
Yeah. But, you know, there was the added pressure. The business was going backwards and going backwards rapidly. So, you know, the stress that you have as a result of that is really tough. But look, we had, you know, it ended well. We had great success. We turned the division around. We drove significant product innovation. We drove, you know, record revenue and profit growth. It was extraordinary. And the retailers really sat up and went. In fact, one of them said to me, I think it might have been the head of Target, said, "Oh my God," she said, "it's been like a tsunami coming through Whole Proof." And not sure everyone liked the tsunami, but yeah. I think it was, because there was no part of that business that we didn't pull apart and put back together again.
What an amazing experience. It just sounds fabulous.
It was. It was tough, though. It was really tough.
But the learning curve was vertical by the sounds of it.
Learning curve was absolutely vertical. And it was actually, it was the time when I really fell in love with China as well, because I was up in China, you know, every sort of 6 or 8 weeks out in the middle of nowhere, at, you know, with our suppliers. It was fantastic, actually.
Yeah, that's great. So I'm just going to fast forward a little bit from that experience at Pacific Brands and talk about your now very impressive portfolio of non-executive board roles. What's your general take on women in boards, their role, their impact? And I think also this concept of quotas, was it that we were to hit 30% of boards to be filled by women by 2018? I'm not actually sure what it is today. I couldn't find anything in my research. So, yeah, did we hit the target? What's your take on all that?
Yeah, we did. It's interesting, Lyndall, you know, that to put the time frame in context, I returned after Pac Brands. I did eventually go up to China. My last executive role was in China for 3 years. I came back, I think, in about 2015, and I had a long-term career aspiration to become a non-executive director one day. I set that back at Clemenger when I joined the board there. So I came back from China and thought, maybe this is the time to do that. Maybe, you know, that was my last executive role and I can make the transition now. 2015 in Australia, the 30% Club had been formed. So it was a global organisation. I think it was founded in the UK. And in Australia, a target was set that 30% of women, you're quite right, would be on the boards of ASX 200 companies by 2018. At 2018, they missed the target. They reached 26.5% in 2018. Mm. And then 2019, I think it hit about 28%. And it took until 2020 to get to 30%. So as we sit here, I haven't seen the 2022 figures, but at the last count, 2021, it was at 32.1%. And once they hit 30% on the ASX 200, the 30% club revised their goal to 30% on the ASX 300.
Okay.
So, you know, I think in a way my timing was right from a number of factors to make the transition. One, there was a lot of active commentary in the market about diversity on the boards of the ASX 200. There was, you know, the work that the 30% Club did in conjunction with the Australian Institute of Company Directors was outstanding. They had a multi-pronged strategy of general publicity about it. They signed up a big chunk of the chairs of ASX 200 companies to commit to, it wasn't a quota, it was just committing to diversity on their boards. They actively, the 30% Club actively engaged the investment community. So every time a board went to present their results, they were getting questions from the major investors as to what they were doing about diversity on their boards. And it got to a point where that influence was really becoming quite intense on companies, to the point that, you know, boards knew that the voting of their REM report was going to be subjected to what was happening with diversity, both on the boards but also in their executive leadership team. So that was happening. And then the other piece that I think was time perfect for me was there was also a big push that there would be more focus on boards on actual customers and consumers. So the voice of the consumer or the skills and experience of a marketing person and potentially adding, you know, digital into that as well. So I think my skills and experience and the timing worked incredibly well for me when I came back from China.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just like the stars really aligned there, didn't they? Coupled with your abilities and what you could actually bring to the boards. That's a fantastic story of how that all worked. Just from a personal perspective, do you subscribe to the requirement of quotas? How do you feel about that now?
Look, some days I do, because I think I get completely frustrated at the slow pace of change. And I think the days that I support it, I think we have tried for so long to demonstrate the value of diversity to organisations, both from an economic and a cultural point of view. But sometimes I think it falls on deaf ears. So, you know, I think sometimes we do need a sledgehammer. I wish that we didn't. But I think that we do. Although, having said that, I actually like, maybe it's the marketer in me, that we just rebrand it and we don't call it quotas, we call it targets.
Yeah.
And the 30% Club used targets.
It
was a quota, you know, because there's sort of there can be unintended consequences with quotas as well.
Totally.
You know, and you, the last thing you want, I think, as a woman or someone from a different cultural background is to be the token person put on a board because you're meeting a quota. You want to be there because of your skills and experience.
Yeah, I'm a believer in merit as well. Yeah. So
meritocracy has not worked for us in the past. I'd go as hard to say it, because it gets used as a reason why women aren't in leadership teams or you know, years ago, you know, chairs or company directors would say, well, yeah, we want more women on our boards. We just don't, there aren't any that are qualified. And it's like, well, there are, you just don't know them because you're in a different network. So I think, I don't know whether I've directly answered your question. Some days when I get angry, I would say, yes, we need quotas. Other days when I'm just sort of trying to be a bit more considered and balanced, I'd say, No, let's put in targets and put a program around achieving those targets that is owned by everyone. That isn't that we've got to fix the women, you know, the fix of this isn't, even though I do believe in mentoring programs, the fix isn't about mentoring women. It's actually a significant attitudinal shift and a belief that this actually delivers a better commercial outcome.
That is the ticket right there, that these choices will actually move the business forward.
And I think, you know, in terms of the boardroom, the skills diversity is critical, because if you've got boards historically were made up of lawyers and accountants, you absolutely need that skill set around the table. There are very complex issues of governance and complexity around financial management as well. So you absolutely have to have those skills. But if you don't have the voice of, if you're a consumer business and you don't have someone thinking from a consumer perspective, or you don't have someone who really understands the digital world and your business is going through a massive transformation in a digital context, then you're not really fully fulfilling your role as a board.
Yeah,
you're actually not considering all aspects of the business. You know, I think the digital context is a really interesting one, because it really, you know, as we were talking early on about when the internet was invented, which actually was in the 60s, but when it commercialized in the 90s, you know, it was really in the domain of marketing. Well, now digital is the whole organization, because and I think that's what's also accelerated the uptake of digital transformation in organizations. It got more traction when the benefits of operationalizing things in a digital way was understood. And for a lot of directors who don't necessarily understand marketing, therefore didn't understand digital, in an operational sense, it's easier to understand because it's a process and you've digitized it and you've driven greater efficiencies in time and cost.
The boards that you do serve on now are actually really, really varied. So I'm interested in what makes you choose the ones that you go on, or maybe they choose you. But, yeah, what attracts you to them? Because they're all really different.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think your point, I will answer that in a minute, but I think your point about you choose them and they choose you is absolutely true in a board role. The due diligence that you do is reflective of the risk that you're about to personally take, because the liabilities are fairly onerous and they're not becoming less onerous. So you really have to give very careful consideration to the boards that you join. I think for me, I think the reason that I have such a diverse portfolio is that I've never been an industry specialist. And I think as a marketer, it's sort of the beauty of working in marketing for as long as I did, is that I worked across a whole lot of industries. And so I do have, you know, broad industry experience. That helps enormously. That in a sense opens up, if I sort of looked at the ASX 200, I could pick a number of companies in a number of sectors where I believe I could add value and that I would have had some experience in across my executive career. So I think that's why I've landed in this diverse, you know,
portfolio.
I think the other piece is, as I mentioned early on, the skills and experience of marketers and people with digital experience is in high demand. So that's why the time was right, in a sense, you know, to bring those skills into the boardroom. So that's given me, you know, a broad palette, in a sense, to paint. The interesting thing for me, I will say, though, the one that I had had no industry experience in, and I wondered why they were even speaking to me, was actually Costa. So I've been on the board of the Costa Group for 6 years.
Is that about food produce?
Costa's is the largest horticultural business in Australia. So they grow, you'd know them as Driscoll's. Driscoll's.
Oh, yes, I see them on my strawberries.
And raspberries. And we also have massive mushroom facilities in both Victoria and South Australia. We are a very, very large citrus grower and tomato grower. We've got huge glass houses in Gara. And we also grow avocados. We have operations all around Australia, so we can supply 52 weeks of the year. And also we grow blueberries up in China for the China market and blueberries in Morocco for the European market. So it's an extraordinary company. So I had no experience in horticulture, and it was really the chair was looking for diversity of skills and really wanted to bring a marketing and consumer perspective to that board. And I've really enjoyed, you know, the 6 years of working on that board, and look forward to the next, you know, however many years that I work with Costa.
Yeah, that's a really interesting company. I mean, we're obviously interested in your arts board's roles and perhaps some of the impacts you may have had there. Is there anything that you can cast your mind back to when you were on MTC board or Melbourne Theatre Company or the Melbourne International Arts Festival that you felt that you really brought to that board role?
Yeah. Oh, look, I have, in fact, right throughout my board career, I've been on arts boards, and it is a personal passion of mine. When I was at Clemenger, the first board that I joined outside of Clemenger was the Melbourne International Festival of the Arts. So I was on that board for 6 years. I think if I look back, it was quite some time ago, but it was once again bringing a marketing perspective. And I remember, you know, working whilst you have broad responsibilities on the board, you know, we were at the time grappling with the increased competition and how to position and strengthen the position of MIFA back then. So I would contribute that perspective to it. I mean, the other role clearly that, you know, on an arts board is fundraising as well. So, you know, you're active in engaging your network in the arts organisation. So, you know, you do quite a bit of advocacy through that as well. I think on MTC, I was on the board of MTC up until 2021, I think, last year. So I was involved with MTC for 6 years. I think I hope that the greatest contribution I made was in two areas. One was being a significant supporter and advocate of the Women in Theatre program that the MTC run, an extraordinary program that mentors women in the industry into a whole lot of roles. You know, whether it's to become an artistic director, to become a lighting designer, designer, etc. That program has evolved significantly under the leadership of Virginia Lovett at the MTC, and it's an extraordinary program. I was together with Lee O'Neill, who's on the foundation board and on the board of MTC now. Lee and I became sort of the lead director sponsors of that program. And we really wanted to engage other women supporting women in the arts. So all of the fundraising, the premise that we had was that women do support women and women are going to support women in the arts. And so we had a whole lot of women who funded that program. Which is fabulous, and that continues to this day. I think the other active involvement that I had was with the marketing team and how to use digital to drive a commercial outcome for the MTC, and the team did all the heavy lifting. I just helped them with the strategy and focus in that area, and the strategy they developed, you know, this is going back years now, was actually all around ticket sales.
Mm.
How to drive ticket sales in a digital environment.
It's what we like to hear. They're two terrific legacies too. So, yeah, well done. It's fabulous. I'm interested to know, and you may not want to answer this question, but with someone with such an impressive career, does imposter syndrome ever sneak into your mindset at times? And if so, how does it present itself?
Oh, completely, completely it does.
Ooh, what a relief. You're not bulletproof.
Look, right throughout my career, I've always been pretty ambitious. And, in fact, I'm sure a lot of friends and peers would say very ambitious. Mm-hmm. I think what's driven that is a desire to do things that I can't do.
Yep.
To go to places that I can't go. So I think I referenced before setting that big audacious goal, you know, back when I joined the board of Clemenger, I think I was 28. And I set that audacious goal that at some time in my career I would become a full-time non-executive director. And it would be of companies that were like the clients that I was working with. So they were all, you know, either one or two in their category. So when that actually happened, when I, you know, came back from China, I was accepted to do the chair's mentoring program at the AICD for 12 months. I landed my first ASX 200 board role, and I remember the imposter syndrome hit when I walked into the boardroom, and I was a bit in shock that I was there. And I sat down, and there's the most, you know, phenomenal people that sit around the table of an ASX 200 company, and I did say to myself inside, how the hell did I get here? So yes, you do. I do. That's how it presented itself for me. And you know, I think it does take a while because it's a big career transition to make. And you're not born a company director. You know, it's like anything, you have to learn it. So you've clearly got skills and experience that have got you to the table. But that's actually the beginning of the story, because you can learn a whole lot of stuff, but there's a whole lot of stuff to learn again. A bit like my experience back at Pack Brands that I shared with you, going, what were my skills and experience that have got me here? And what are the things that I know? And what are the things that I don't know? And how am I going to fill those gaps? And how am I going to learn about that? So I think, you go on a steep learning curve again, which is what I actually love about it. One day I'll be so happy when I'm, you know, going to be content laying on a banana lounge somewhere under a palm tree. But
I can't see that.
I can't see it either because I sort of get this skid out of it. But, I hope I answered your question.
You seem to be comfortable in the uncomfortable, and that is a that's a kind of a personality type, I guess. And, yeah, it just stretches you by putting yourself in places you haven't been before and figuring out how to step up to the mark. So
yeah, and I think too, just
inspirational.
I'm uncomfortable in the uncomfortable. You've got to go, how do I get comfortable in the uncomfortable?
Yeah,
and that just goes back to learning again. And I think that's why, you know, earlier on we were talking about the whole emergence of the internet. I loved it because it was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable for organizations. It was uncomfortable for people not knowing. It was uncomfortable learning and going, what does all of this stuff mean? And I think that my personality is drawn to that. I think it's why I like working across a whole lot of industries as well, because they each have different problems to solve, and, you know, and you sort of work your way through what those issues are. And more often than not, they're in an unfamiliar environment, like the Costa example that I gave you.
Mm.
I didn't know about horticulture at all. Now I know a lot about it.
But you don't when you start.
No,
Yeah, it's fascinating. Now, we love a bit of advice here on ACMN Conversations. So focusing in on women in business as we are today, what are your tips for our ladies that are listening to expand their careers?
Look, it's a tough one. It's so personal because I think it comes back to what your goals and aspirations are. I think it's, I've always been a great believer in setting really long-term goals. So I think it's time to, I would advise everyone to just stop and think about that and think about, you know, how long we're going to live and how long you're going to work, or, and in the context of how long you're going to live, what sort of life you want to have later on, you know, because at some point in time, your executive career comes to an end, whether that's your doing or not. It comes a point in time where I think we run out of the fire in the belly for it, but we've still got a lot to give. So I think it's thinking about, you know, the thinking about your career in big chunks and big phases, and set some goals about, you know, what do I think my career looks like from 60 to 70? Because all of a sudden you're going to be 60. It's sort of, it's a horrible thought, but all of a sudden that actually does happen to all of us. And you start going, well, do I still want to be doing what I'm doing now at 60, or do I want to be doing something else? And then when I'm, you know, hopefully 80, what sort of lifestyle do I want to have? So I think setting an audacious goal is a good thing and working towards it. Someone recently said to me, we overestimate what we can do in a year and we underestimate what we can do in a decade. And I think that's really true with our careers, that we sort of think, you know, I mentor quite a few people, and quite often I think in early stage career, it's just all, it's a high level, I'm generalizing, but a level of impatience and what I'm going to do this year. It's like, well, let's sort of think about the next 5 years, or let's think about the next decade. Because we can achieve a hell of a lot in a decade, but it's sort of good to have some goals that you're heading towards something. So I'm a great advocate for setting some really long-term goals.
I think that's a really great tip and something that has gone missing. And I sort of reference the digital age. You know, everyone's moving at the speed of light, and people in digital roles don't stay in digital roles for very long. They turn over really, really quickly. And I do think perhaps we've lost the sense of long-term career planning, because new ideas and new opportunities are just presenting themselves to us in the short term. It's really easy to get distracted and lose sight of that long-term vision or that long-term picture. So I think that's a really helpful tip.
Yeah, I think some of that turnover, it's very topical in the context of COVID, because we are seeing that demand's out there for great digital marketers, which is a great time for people in marketing who have those skills, because they're in demand. I think what a lot of through the people that I mentor, what I see is the search for a culture that they're aligned to. So I think if we in our career, and my sort of second bit of advice is actually, you know, really assessing whether you're in a culture where you can be your best as well. So I think some of the turnover is in search of a culture that you can really align with and values that you align with. But some of it is also supply and demand and the opportunity to move quickly. And that's great. Early stage career, to be able to move up that ladder pretty quickly and get diverse experience across a whole lot of different roles is a great thing. But I think it's sort of like, what's the end goal? What do you want to do, and where do you want to be in 10 years? And, you know, and I think for women, you know, we could be factoring in, you know, do we want to partner up? Do we want to have children? How does that all fit in our life plan as well?
Yeah, that's great advice. And probably one last one, networking and relationships and the the essence of relationships being the key to doing good work is a topic that comes up a lot on our podcast. So it's people supporting people, women supporting women that influence your, I guess, career growth or your career outcomes or even your business outcomes. So if you had a couple of tips on being a great networker and someone who is good at, you know, really, I guess, making the most out of their relationships, what would they be?
Yes, well, I'd say make the effort. That's the first tip. Make the effort to get outside your comfort zone, because networking is a bit of a dirty word, particularly for women.
Yeah.
But like, make the effort to go out and be interested and be interesting. So I think that's the first thing. I think you've got to, the second thing I'd say is, you know, spend time doing things outside your day job. And outside your organization, in places and with people around topics of interest.
Mm.
So, you know, and that could be industry specific things. It could be, for me, it was the arts. So it was to me, arts was in parallel with working in an agency environment because it was highly creative. But it was very much outside, you know, the agency world. And, you know, that board role of working on Mitha just opened up my world to a whole other network of people, both in the corporate context and in the arts world. And a number of those people that I met who were on the board of Mitha with me at the time have absolutely fantastic close friends now. Mm-hmm. So some of them became friends as well as you know, you're part of your cheer squad too. And it was just interesting, you know. So I think find things that you're interested in. And then I also think with networking, you know, the other part of it is giving back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's where you're spending your time to give back to others. And so it's not always, sometimes I think why networking's got a bad rap, it's sort of like this, you're out on this mission, like an Exocet missile, trying to find someone or some connection who's going to do something fabulous for you.
Yeah, what's in it for me?
So I think if you flip it over and go, how can I give back in this context? And I mean, I love getting out and about. COVID's been a killer for me because we've been locked up and I haven't been able to go to anything. I haven't been to the theatre, but I have now. But, you know, that I think, yeah, so they're the three things. Make an effort.
Yeah.
You know, find things that are relevant to your career and or your interests and give back.
Jeanette, there's just so many tidbits of useful information in the conversation that we've had today. So thank you for sharing your journey and your experiences and all those wise words along the way. Before we let you go, we do like to ask a few questions that are important to us. And I'll start with our big one. Why does arts matter to you?
To me personally?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh. Well,
we've had lots of different answers to this one, so take it any way you like.
Yeah. Do you know, it really matters to me because of how it makes us all feel and how the arts has this extraordinary ability to connect us to things that matter, to challenge us with things in society that we find difficult to confront. You know, it's this rich tapestry of reflecting the good and the bad things about us as humans. So it matters to me from that point of view. I think it selfishly matters to me because it's just a wonderful escape as well.
Isn't it? That leads probably very nicely on what I think you might tell us is the last piece of great theatre that you saw.
Yes, well,
I was not rigged, by the way, everybody.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I, you know, with this being in lockdown in Melbourne for so long, you know, I think that one of talking to friends and family, the thing that we all missed most was going to the theatre. And I was just so excited as we came out of the last lockdown to go to the family and friends night of Moulin Rouge. And it truly was just the most wonderful experience. Every moment of it was just electric, from queuing up outside the theatre to get in, to standing in that foyer of, you know, the most beautiful, beautiful theatre that had been restored. Everyone was waiting with so much anticipation and joy in that foyer, and to be reconnected with one another. But it was actually so important where we were reconnecting. So I haven't even got to the show yet. But
drum roll, please.
The anticipation of going in there was just extraordinary. It was so palpable in that foyer, and the moment of absolute magic when the doors opened and in we went to this whole magical world of escapism. It was just, and then the show is, words can't describe how magical and outstanding that show was. And I think I had a grin, biggest grin on my face from beginning to end. You know, I didn't want to sleep that night. I came home, actually, I jumped online and bought two tickets for my son and his fiance for them to go and see it, which they did, and they loved it. But it was a sheer joy. It would be an extraordinary show at any time, but at the time that I saw it, and I think for the city still, Melbourne is still just, you know, it's like the biggest gift, that show to Melbourne.
I was going to say the same thing. It's been
lots of people are talking about it in that context as well. Yeah. They're breathlessly talking about the performance and the whole show, and at the same time going, oh my God, it is so much what we needed. It is an extraordinary gift. To this city. It was phenomenal.
It was a good comeback piece, that one. That's that is for sure. And just out of interest, where did you discover your love of theatre and entertainment?
I'll try and make the story short, but I was, you know, very fortunate as a young kid that my mum and dad loved taking us to the theatre. So I grew up going to the ballet, you know, through my, you know, high school years, went to the MTC, you know, the classic, all of the research that's done by the arts industry shows, you know, how you get people engaged in the theatre. And I think I'm a bit of a case study of that. My father, as his side hustle, was actually a projectionist. So we actually went to the movies a lot. And Dad was like the old style picture show man. And so I think it was, you know, through Dad's love of film as well and the theatre. And in fact, later on in his life, he actually initiated the showing of cinema accompanied by live performance in at the Arts Centre. I think the first, he had this idea to merge the two together. Dad did that, and in retirement he worked in at the Arts Centre as well. And so it's in and around my life the whole time. So he was very proud when I sort of got onto the board of MIFA, and sadly he's not alive now, but he would have been overjoyed knowing that I was involved with the MTC for 6 years as well.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that fabulous? It's such good memories, isn't it, when all the stuff we're exposed to when we were little, and that is where it all starts for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, Gina, thank you so much for your time today. There's been some wonderful insights. I could talk to you all day and just hear about your career and your guidance and where life takes everybody. So thank you very much for your time. It's been terrific chatting to you.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, Lyndall. And thank you so much for being so patient listening to my stories. But, you know, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.